The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we have the honor and privilege of talking for the first part of our program with Wangari Maathai, who is 2004 became the first woman in Africa to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. She's a former member of parliament, an environmental minister in Kenya, author of numerous books. Her recent book, which is a phenomenal book we're going to talk about, The Challenge for Africa, which talks to Americans especially, I think. She's the subject of a new PBS Independent Lens documentary called Taking Root, The Vision of Wangari Maathai. It'll be airing Saturday on WETA in the Washington metro area at 10:30 on April 25th. On HUT at Howard University at 8 p.m. And here on Maryland Public Television on April 14th at 10 p.m. We'll give you all that information again. And Wangari Maathai, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's an honor to have you. And did I do your last name justice?
Yes, indeed. It's perfect.
Good. Making sure.
Yes, indeed.
So for those Americans and those people listening to our program now, who may not know your name, though most people do, I think, and many people do. You won the Nobel Prize in 2004 and for a really very unique program that caught the world's eye, the Green Belt Movement. Talk a bit about that. Give us a piece of that history first, if you might.
We started the program, the Green Belt Movement, in 1977, and it was to respond to the felt needs of communities, especially women who needed firewood, who needed to stop soil erosion, who needed to improve their food, and who also needed an income and clean drinking water. So when we started, it was not to create a movement, it was not to create a global issue, but once we started seeing how so many issues were interconnected, and we kept pursuing them, and they led us to governance issues, they led us to conflict issues and to equity issues, and now we are discussing global warming issues. So it's really been a phenomenal development from a simple activity of planting trees.
Now, but I don't want to belabor this too much because I really want to talk about this book and what you're saying to the world, which is just, I think people need to hear what's going on in the continent and don't really have a grasp of it, and you're really giving the West a grasp of this book. But the road you took was not an easy road. I mean, you won the Peace Prize for this, the Nobel Peace Prize, but you, as the first woman in Kenya to come home with a PhD...
Yes, I think it was a great privilege to have that, and I owe it to my mother especially, who at a time when girls were not going to school, she was willing to let me go.
And when you came back, though, you faced a lot. I mean, you and your husband divorced. You had to face the wrath of many men and women who called you an elitist, who attacked you. I mean, you were confronted. Your life was threatened. I mean, you ended up being a minister in the government, but what you did, I think, is nothing short of amazing, given the status of women and what's happened to women in African society.
Yeah, I think looking back, it does look amazing. But I had the fortune of traveling abroad, coming to this country, spending almost 5.5 years, getting a master's degree, a bachelor, first of all, in Atchison, Kansas, in a small college known then as Mount St. Scholastica, but is now known as Benedictine College, and then going to the University of Pittsburgh and getting a master's in biological sciences. So I think the exposure, and especially during the 60s, during the struggles in this country for human rights and the work of Martin Luther King and Andrew Young and such great leaders at that time really inspired me and helped me to form an opinion that eventually helped me tackle the same issues when I went back home.
And if you could describe for us, it's a piece of that moment, because when you got your PhD when you came to America to become the first East African woman to earn a PhD here. You went back. I mean, and this is a time when there were great African leaders like Jomo Kenyatta, like Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, men who kind of led the way and had great vision and hope for the future of Africa. But then you were confronted with who became the kind of autocratic leader of Kenya, Daniel Arap Moi, and had to face down that government to fight for the rights of women and for the environment.
Yes, and it's very unfortunate because the African people were very hopeful that once they had gotten rid of colonialism, they would be able to lead a more respected life. They would take their position amongst the nations, at the United Nations, and they would improve their quality of life. And it was in many ways a disappointment, a betrayal for Africans that their leaders, especially after the first leaders, certainly in some cases the very leaders who took power, that there was so much retrogression, and leaders, instead of offering their people a better quality of life, they started really leaving it up and ignoring the needs of their people, so that we ended up with the dictators and people who cared little and who just wanted to live a luxurious life in state houses. So it was very, very disappointing. And as you know, we are still going through that process of trying to get rid of them, trying to improve the democratic space, trying to reintroduce basic human rights. But it has been a big struggle for the African people.
This is your opportunity to speak directly with Wangari Maathai, who is the first woman in Africa to win the Nobel Peace Prize. She did so in 2004. She's a former member of parliament, environmental minister in Kenya. She is an activist fighting for a new Africa, a democratic Africa, an Africa that is home to women who have equal rights to men, who's fighting for the environment, which is one of the reasons she won that Nobel Prize. There's a new PBS documentary called Taking Root, The Vision of Wangari Maathai, which will air this Saturday on WETA at 10 o'clock and on April 25th on WHUT at 8 p.m. at Howard University Public Television and on Maryland Public Television on April 14th at 10 p.m. But you can speak to her directly now at 410-319, and it's your chance to talk to her at this moment. Very few people have that opportunity. It's yours right now. Let me talk about this book. I mean, there's so much you say in these 300 pages. It's almost hard to know where to begin, but let me begin at kind of maybe one of the central points. And you have the continent of Africa, where nations were created out of whole cloth by European powers in the 1800s.
Yes.
Creating countries called Tanganyika and Kenya and Nigeria that never existed before.
Yes.
And you call what we in the West say tribes, you call them micronations.
Yes.
So talk about that history and this theory of micronationality and how you see it kind of changing the framework of Africa now and what we need to understand from the West.
The concept I'm dealing with here is the fact that quite often when we talk about nations, we talk about Kenya, Nigeria, Sudan, we envision nations in the same concept as we do in the West. Yet, many of the Western countries have been shaped by their history, by their wars, by their struggles, by their linguistic affiliations, by their cultures, and therefore have been more natural boundaries. And although, as I say, they have been shaped by wars, there have been wars where treaties have been signed and people within the borders have agreed that we are France, we are Germans, we are Spaniards, we are Portuguese and such. Now, when you come to Africa, we had communities that could also have gotten together to form similar nations. But that's not where we were historically. We were at a place where we were still small nations, some of them more bigger than others. But we had not yet gone through the process of coming together, even amongst those of us who were closely related and affiliated. But within the areas where we lived, we had the same characters or the same parameters that would qualify a French, a German, an English, a Scottish person. And in fact, when I mentioned Scottish and English and Welsh and Irish, these are tribes.
That's right.
These are tribes, but they have learned in the course of history, they have learned to stay together. It is in the interest, in their interest, politically and economically, to operate together. They may have come through their leaders. But in Africa, this has not yet happened. People are still thinking as the individual communities that the British or the French or the Portuguese encountered. And we must also remember that these colonial powers survived partly by encouraging these micro-nationalities to hate each other, to disagree with each other, the whole concept of divide and rule. So we developed biases against each other, and we prejudices against each other, and we use these now, as I would say, politicians use these now to incite the public against each other. And that's what we saw, for example, in Kenya last year.
Yes.
But we must realize that these are issues that we have not yet resolved, because we have not yet sat down around the table to create the nations as other nations have been created.
And I want to talk about the next step to that, but let me open the phones and let people join us here as we talk to Nobel Prize winner Wangari Maathai, who is traveling the United States from her home in Kenya. Her book, which is really something that people who care about Africa and care about our future, care about democracy and the environment and women and all the rest, need to read, called The Challenge for Africa by Wangari Maathai. 410-319-8888 is the number here. 410-319-8888. And Laurie in Annapolis, you're on the air.
Good evening to you and your guest. I just wanted to state that Ms. Maathai, I think that you're an inspiration. Your work is admirable. You're actually a heroine. And I myself did environmental landscaping and tree planting in Botswana in 1988 as a volunteer for Operation Crossroads Africa. So I personally was so inspired by your story and your courage. And you're really just a hero and a shining beacon for all women worldwide.
Thank you so much. You're very kind.
Thank you.
And I would add to what Laura says, not just trying to become just for women, but for men, too. Men who want to listen, that is.
Yeah.
410-319-8888. And Cliff, on your cell, you're on the air.
Greetings. Hello, Mark. And
welcome.
I'm honored to be able to speak with Madam Wangari Maathai. I guess I should say Queen Mother. You haven't been officially designated one, and you should have been, I think, long ago. You were just talking a little while ago about the whole divide and rule concept. And, of course, we have that here in the United States, especially among, I think, what we euphemistically call the African-American community, where we are divided against each other, even in terms of locality, in terms of skin pigmentation and everything else. But I was curious about one particular issue, and that is with regard to the African Union and also with regard to the diaspora, the African diaspora around the world. There's an effort to organize African people in the diaspora, whether they are born in Africa or born here in the United States, as I am or was, to petition the African Union to join its Economic, Social, and Cultural Council. And there are six states, for instance, that have organized around this effort, and we're trying to get more states to organize around this effort. And I just wanted to get maybe whatever perspectives you might have on that effort, what you think the prospects are, how effective do you think it's going to be, and what would you say to individuals who are either apathetic to that idea or, in some cases, in direct opposition to it?
Well, I thank you very much for your compliment. What I would say is that, in fact, I was the interim president of the ECOSOC, And we have just, as you know, created the permanent body, and that is now in operation. Is being led by a very wonderful lawyer from Cameroon called Mr. His name is escaping my mind, but he is from Cameroon, Mr. Kuna, I think. And it's a great idea from the African Union, and I think it should be supported. I think they are still working out the mechanisms to include the diaspora, and it would be, create a wonderful forum to be able to interact with the heads of state directly and shape, help to shape the destiny of Africa. I think the ideas in the African Union are extremely wonderful, but we really need the African leadership to move beyond the ideas and beyond the rhetoric and be committed to these ideas in terms of financial support, and also make sure that they support these ideas at the national level as well.
I'm Mark Steiner. We have the privilege of talking to a Nobel Peace Prize winner, Wangari Maathai. Her latest book, The Challenge for Africa, the number is 410-319-8888. We'll come to more of your calls at 410-319-8888. You, in your book, when you talk about these micronations, probably the, one of the countries that is in most desperate shape in the whole continent is the Congo. And you have an entire chapter on saving the Congo forests. And you talk about in that chapter 50 million people from 150 distinct micronations, you know, ranging from small-scale farmers to hunter-gatherers and everything beyond. And I, when you look at the country like that and you look at what's going on and that how much of the war in the Congo is fueled by the desire for people to control the mineral wealth of that nation, both internally and externally, where does it begin? Where does the concept of micronations even start to help make a country that could be one of the wealthiest, most powerful nations on the planet Earth whole again?
Well, I would say this, that a lot of the people, a lot of those micronations have no clue what is happening to Congo.
Mm-hmm.
They have no idea that they live in an extremely rich country. They also, they probably think that fate has it that they should be poor. But the people who really know what is happening in that country and who can work towards making these micronationalities work together are their leaders. Their leaders. And I think that what we need to do is emphasize to the leaders of Africa that nobody else is going to help their people if they cannot help their people. And so they need to rise beyond the selfishness of wanting to be president, wanting to be minister, wanting to be permanent secretary, wanting to assume powerful positions, not to serve their people, but to enjoy the privileges that come with that power at the expense of their own people. The people who are mining the resources of Congo are not Congolese. Many of them are not Congolese. Maybe the top 10% elites are making are either mining or making arrangements for those who mine. So the book, Challenge for Africa, is really, to a very large extent, a challenge to the leadership of Africa.
And how do you think they'll, I mean, you let me ask you to kind of pursue that a bit more, but let me take you through another piece in your book. I mean, you, towards the end of your book, you list all these wonderfully incredible people, some of whom we know and some of whom we may never heard of before, who are fighting for peace, who are kind of creating these movements, the West African Network for Peace Building, and you write about Deka Ibrahim Abdi, a Muslim woman from Kenya, and the work that she's doing, and all these other people. So how do the talk about the forces for peace and understanding in Africa, who nobody pays attention to, just like they don't pay attention to the forces of peace among Israelis and Palestinians. They only pay attention to all the rest. How do they have an effect? What do they do to change the way nations in Africa work with one another and work internally?
Well, it is true that there are lots of movements in Africa, grassroots movements, movements of human rights, women movements, that are constantly scratching the ground. And sometimes they make a dent. Sometimes they don't. But all of those efforts can be annihilated. They can be wiped out, I want to say, by bad leadership. And we have seen situations such as we saw in Kenya last year in January, when people were saying we are very surprised to see Kenya on fire. Mm-hmm. Some of us were not surprised because we had seen it coming, mm-hmm. and we had said so. We saw Luanda several years down the road, and many people said they were surprised. A lot of Luandese would tell you we saw it coming. So these efforts that are being made by ordinary citizens are wonderful initiatives, and eventually they will give us the critical mass of people that we need to put pressure on the leaders. But I'm also hoping that we can have great leaders. Every country can, many countries in the world get great leaders. In this country, you celebrate leaders like Abraham Lincoln and many other leaders who helped shape this country. They could have, they could also have decided to go to State House, to the White House, and live happily ever after. But they were committed to the welfare of their country, to the welfare of their people, and they came up with a constitution which today the Americans are still going to in order to get their justice. And therefore, it is possible to have African leaders who can be exemplary. We saw some of them, as you mentioned earlier, Kenyatta, Nyerere, Nkrumah. But we saw also that partly because of the Cold War, many of these leaders were removed and dictators were installed and supported by the developed world because of the competition of the Cold War.
So talk about who the leaders are now for you. I mean, who among the leaders in Africa, whether they are elected to office or in office or fighting for democracy, are the ones that you look to as the hope of the future where nations in Africa are going?
Well, I think that for me, I would really have to think hard because, you know, it's very easy to pick leaders that are recently installed, such as the president of Sierra Leone, Sirleaf Johnson, Johnson Sirleaf, and I know she's doing a stunning job, but I wish she did not inherit a devastated country, so that we would really see her utilize her potential in developing that country, and we need to see that happen so that we don't judge her by what she is doing within a few months. We saw people like Mandela, who came out and managed the country for 5 years and handed it over to younger people. And there was a great leader. But I can count them by the hand. Apparently, they are beginning to think hard for who is the next one.
What about at home in Kenya? I mean, how are things going since the election and the bloodletting, and then the leaders got together to form a coalition government? How is it going in Kenya at the moment?
Well, it's not going very well because we have a lot of competition amongst the politicians who created the government. As you know, when we agreed to create a government, we created the largest government we have ever seen. And we did that because we wanted as many people as possible to be in the cabinet, not to serve, but to enjoy the privileges that come with those positions. Mm-hmm. And we did that at a time when we had over 500,000 people displaced, and who some of whom are still living in internally displaced refugee camps. That is not a demonstration of people who really care for their people. Those are people who are just thinking about themselves. And now they are beginning to push and pull each other, because they are now thinking about 2012, when we shall have the next general election. That's what is happening in Kenya. Very disappointing.
We are taking the next few minutes with Wangari Maathai, of course, Nobel Peace Prize winner from Kenya. Her latest book is The Challenge for Africa. And her documentary about her work, called Taking Root, The Vision of Wangari Maathai, will be airing this Saturday in ETA at 10:30 and April 25th on HUT at 8 p.m. and Brandon Public Television at 10 p.m. on April the 14th. Number is 410-319-8888. And so when you go back, going back to kind of the some of the heart of what you're talking about, embracing micronations, and you talk about the children of these different, all these nations learning their own tribes, whether it's languages, whether it's Hausa, Igbo, Yoruba, as you write about, or in Senegal, Pular, and the other languages. How do we get beyond that? How do you create a pride in a nation and at the same time build a new nation?
Well, you know, I personally think that there are certain things that we may not be able to do because we are poor still. We don't have the capital. We don't have the skills. We don't have knowledge. We don't have teachers. It will take time to build. But the most important thing is really just to have a leadership that is recognizing this. And it's also very important to have leaders who are honest. It's quite possible for us to be honest with each other and to come to the table and say, you know, like in Kenya, there are 42 communities. We would like to have children learn every language, but we don't have the capacity. But we will start somewhere. We will start with the larger communities. We have four major communities that easily can form 60% of the population. Then at least you would be able to have people who understand each other. And people who, when their leaders talk to them, understand them. Today, when the leader talks to them, only about 20% maybe understand what they're talking about because they are speaking in a foreign language. And majority of the people may not even know how to read and write. Take Congo. How many people can speak French? So when a president stands up and speaks French, he's speaking to his colleagues, not to his citizens.
It's a very important point. I wish we had more time, but I know that you wrote this wonderful article about Barack Obama, and we talked this wonderful article about Barack Obama. And when you did talk about that, America has a huge role playing this in changing trade policies. But we'll have to take that on another day. And Wangari Maathai, thank you so much for being with us and gracing our airwaves for this half hour.
You.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
And her book, The African, The Challenge of Africa, and you can catch her on public television stations and go to our website, steinershow.org, to find out more about that. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Peter Weibrow, who thinks America is dangerously addicted to many things they should not be. We're going to talk about that and wrestle those issues when we return. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still there to help people during difficult times. For more information, go to mecu.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. A dear friend of mine, Louisa Nielsen, forwarded me this article by Dr. Peter Weibrow called Dangerously Addictive. And I was just fascinated by it, and then got his book called American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. And his second book is The Intuitive Mind, Common Sense for the Common Good, which will be published next year. And this article that I read came out of the Chronicle for Higher Education, arguing that humans are ill-suited to a lifestyle of consumerism and ill-suited to the world we live in. Maybe we're just basically paleolithic creatures trapped in this modern world. He's also director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at the University of California, Los Angeles, and is a physician. And Peter Weibrow, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. Let's just start. I mean, the article that caught my attention before I even picked up your book you're saying things that some people have tried to say over the years, but not as effectively, I think.
Well, thank you.
And talk a bit about the concept that I threw out there, and if it is even close to it, which is that we're basically all paleolithic creatures stuck in a technological world and we don't know how to live in it.
Well, there's some, that's a, I think that's a good, uh, good précis of what I said exactly. I think actually we are pretty Paleolithic. The interesting thing about the human brain is that it has evolved over many millions of years, but what makes it human is really only a couple of hundred years old, actually, 100,000 years old. It's, you know, we all grew up in Africa, and it was peculiar that through just a couple of strange happenings, we developed a frontal cortex, which is capable of long-term planning and abstract thinking. But fundamentally, we still are creatures of immediacy. You know, we, as your previous guest was speaking about, and I was privileged to listen to her a little bit, Wangari Maathai, she was saying much the same as I am, only it's a different continent. That, mm-hmm. In fact, there are a lot of people in her world at the moment who are seeking self-interest, and of course, that's exactly what happens to us because it's instinctual, and we drive for the immediate pleasure. And it doesn't matter whether you're doing that by becoming a member of parliament in an African country or whether you're doing that by becoming a CEO of a large company. The problem is that the balance of human behavior, which must offset this instinctual drive, which is, my statement is not that that's bad, it's just that one needs a balance to it, and that balance is in fact social behavior and social interaction, which moderates the pleasure and the instinct by essentially bringing you back to the reality of your social circumstance. And that, of course, was true when we all lived in small communities in Europe and then in the U.S. And it's true, I'm sure it was true in Africa and probably still is, living in small communities which have been broken up by our modern life, both there and in the U.S.
Now, what you're talking about there, I'd like to lead to in just a second, which is your conversation about Adam Smith and how he may have been right on some levels, but our society has gone so far beyond what he thought we could that it's mm-hmm. turned us upside down. But I want to go back to the very beginning just for a moment because you started in a very humorous way, which I like. Your article was started with a quote by George Carlin.
Yes, one of my favorites, actually.
He says, you write, it's called The American Dream, George Carlin lamented shortly before his death last year, because you have to be asleep to believe it. Too bad for the rest of us that Carlin and his signature satire haven't been around for the wake-up call for the current market meltdown.
Right. It's true. I mean, his daughter, who is making a film about the American Dream, gave me that quote. And if you look him up on the web, you'll find that just before he died, he had a whole series of presentations in which he quite pithily pointed out that if you stand back and you use the rational mind, which is this most recently evolved mind that I was talking about, what we sometimes call the executive mind, it is in fact very clear that we're doing things which are self-destructive, but we're doing them in terms of the short-term gain. I give you an example. I was at dinner a week or so ago with some friends at a very nice little local bistro, and he's a fun fellow who runs it, so we had a good dinner and we all were quite content, and three of us, and we're just about to leave, and he likes us, so he suddenly turned up. He's from Canada and from Montreal and French and speaks very, you know, like a Frenchman. And he comes in and he says, don't go, I have a new tiramisu from Montreal, you must try it. So we're sitting there, and we're all quite content, but he brings this slab of tiramisu, and of course in 10 seconds it had disappeared, because we cannot, there's a whole bunch of research that shows this, that when you're presented with something that is abstract, and you say, well, would you prefer $10 now or $100 in a week? Most people will say, I prefer $100 in a week, or to translate it to the tiramisu, would you like a small piece now or a cake, a big piece later on? Most people will say, I'll wait. But when it's in front of you, you can't wait. And this is the whole dilemma of the human frailty, that we somehow have to grasp that abundance in this country it's a different issue in Africa, but abundance, where we have, you know, 1,259 hair treatments to choose from in the grocery store, it's a nightmare. You know, we don't know what to do, and so we indulge our sense of curiosity and self-interest, and through that to just try to climb up the social ladder, whereas in fact we should be thinking about what we do interactively rather than personally and selfishly.
I'm curious about for you the intersection of all this. I mean, you write about, as you do in your book, the workings of the brain and how the brain evolved from our reptilian brain to what we have now, and how they work together. And then you kind of very neatly pull in Adam Smith, who was kind of the father of capitalism, for want of a better term. But that something then went awry. I mean, if things were working on some levels for a long time, something has happened to dangle. We used to have to find fruit trees, but now we have candy in front of us 24 hours a day. You go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that the interesting thing about Smith is that, of course, he's held up as being the person who quantified our present market system, which we call capitalism, which is just an evolution, really, of what we've done for many thousands of years. If you look back into the history of the human race, in fact, even if you go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, as I did a month or so ago, they have an exhibit called Beyond Babylon. And Babylon was a market society just like we are. It didn't have Adam Smith to codify it. What Smith said simply was that if you think of society as a balance, on one side, what drives the market is self-interest, curiosity, and social ambition. They're the engines of the market. And he knew that human beings were greedy. I mean, in the 18th century when he was writing, everybody knew that the human being was greedy, and they were afraid that when the church lost its grip, which it was doing, the Roman Catholic Church in Europe, everybody said, well, we're all going to run to the dogs and it'll be a mess. And what Smith argued and some others argued is that no, because we live in small communities, we'll actually pay attention to each other, and we won't let the vagabonds get away with everything. We'll keep them in check. And in fact, if people put their local capital, their own resources, into a community, and they are there with others also putting local resources into the community, then there will be a natural balance, what he called the invisible hand. And this indeed works out. If you have small internet communities where interconnected, I suppose internet is rather a different word these days, but interconnected communities, what happens is that people monitor each other, and they, you know, if the fellow who makes shoes down the streets uses inferior leather, then after a while nobody buys his shoes. So his own capital is in that business, so he's mindful of the fact that he needs to do a good job. And when you see a system like that, that is a balanced market society, which Smith argued was self-regulating, and therefore you didn't need government to get in the way. And there are a few frills and whistles we can put on there, but just for the sake of this discussion, that's basically the principle. Then you fast forward, you know, and you find that the instinctual side, especially in trickle-down Reaganomics and Thatcherism in England, is in fact still using the same engine. It's self-interest, curiosity, and social ambition. Whereas on the other side, the community aspects of things have tended to fall apart. We don't live in the same communities as we used to. Government regulation then takes that over, but government regulation is a much more blunt instrument than the nuance of knowing your friends and doing things which you don't want to be shamed for, but you want to feel proud of, and so on. You get the idea.
So, but I wonder on a couple levels here. One is that whether the very nature of the market system itself can ever accomplish for what Adam Smith set out to do, given our predispositions human beings to want more when it's in front of us. And being greedy, it's the nature of humankind to kind of stuff itself for the winter, however we play that out.
Mm-hmm.
That then, and if the nature of the marketplace also is to gobble up smaller markets and grow, which is done now exponentially, and then the technology added on that has made it so connected and interactive all the time that we can never get away from anything. That whether or not that vision works in the 21st century, and how that changes.
No, you're absolutely right. It's a conundrum. I mean, it's a big problem. And I think this is what we've got to put our best minds to thinking about and to figuring out how it can be, how the best of the market system can be sustained and how at the same time we can build a stronger infrastructure. You know, the whole issue is really how do we develop a society with sustainable wealth? And unfortunately, we tend to interpret wealth in a material context. Where, of course, wealth is much more than just materialism. If you think of it, you're broadcasting out of the East, and there were many states in the East that started with the name the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, mm-hmm. etc.
Mm-hmm.
That was a significant word because it meant that not only did you vote collectively, but you also held in common certain things which had to be there in order to form a platform for the opportunity for capital markets to work properly. You had to have, for example, security. You have to have a set of rules where you're not going to run off with somebody else's treasure when they put it in your business, etc. So these types of covenants, which we all have and we get used to in a country like this where we have freedom of expression and so on, these things are very, very important, and that part of the Commonwealth. But there's another part of the Commonwealth, too, which is an educational system which enables us to move through the social hierarchy based upon talent. We think we have that here, but unfortunately we no longer do. It's the same with healthcare. That contains people in ways which are actually quite significant when it comes to enabling them to move easily through the social order. So this type of commonwealth has to be thought through, but then the real problem comes, how do you sustain something like that when you have to build some material wealth which is tied to the market? So it becomes an extremely complex issue, and unfortunately we tend to radicalize it. You know, we tend to say, oh, Obama's a socialist because he wants to bring in healthcare.
Right.
And he's a tyrant. He's the new Black Caesar, you know, who's a tyrant. Well, the alternative interpretation of that is that he's using his, to use a technical term, his lateral prefrontal cortex, which is this piece of the brain which we inherited recently. He's using that in a thoughtful, planning way to bring up questions about how do we develop a sustainable society which both has the capacity to develop a material infrastructure which will support us, because that's very important. You know, it's not an issue of doing away with local entrepreneurship and having central planning. They tried that in Russia and that didn't work. But on the other hand, we need to have a balance between that local entrepreneurship and, as you point out, especially as it tends in the competitive world of markets to become centralized and then much less local and much less open to control, we have to have something that helps regulate that and creates this other wealth, which is the social infrastructure. And it's not just social in the sense of, you know, everybody having a welfare check.
Mm-hmm.
It's bridges that work, it's schools that work, it's health systems that work. And although we don't like to do it in this country, actually there are some elements of Europe which have gone further down the road of solving this problem than we have. And of course we've convinced ourselves that we've created the best civilization the world has ever known, so we can't look anywhere else for help.
Of course not.
Which is a problem. But if you get my drift, it's really, and you can, you know, you can roll this back into, and that's a wonderful thing about neuroscience now, you can see why this is happening. Smith understood it from the behavioral standpoint, but now what has happened is we've validated it from the neurobiological standpoint, because he was right.
And I'm going to get to that.
But he was wrong.
Oh, I'm sorry, Peter. Yeah. I need to jump in there.
No, no, I'm chattering on.
No, 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 it's fine, it's fine. It's radio. You're supposed to chatter on. Dr. Peter Weibrow is with us. We discovered him in an article written for the Chronicle of Higher Education called Dangerously Addictive, Why We Are Biologically Ill-Suited to the Riches of Modern America, and his book then, American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. Dr. Weibrow joins us from California. The number here is 410-319-8888. Before we go to our first caller, who is from New York, let me ask you to kind of expound what you're about to go to here for a moment, which is this idea, when you talked about the prefrontal cortex, but the evolution of the limbic cortex from our most primitive brains on Earth to where we are now, and why that in itself leads to the personal contradiction we all live with the overabundant American society.
Well, we grew up in scarcity. That's the most important thing to remember. I mean, most animals are tuned to figure out a way of surviving in the rough. And so we have an old lizard brain, so-called because it's very similar to even modern lizards, but we shared that with the dinosaurs. Mammals came along, and they were characterized by caring for their young and developing this cortex. Now, that cortex has evolved over millions of years, and we are part of the primate species, and we have several other Homo primates, which came before us, Homo erectus, Neanderthals, things like that. But we most recently developed in the last 200,000 years or so this lateral cortex, and also a much more efficient brain in many ways. Too short a time to go into that. But the interesting thing is that when we're faced with abundance, don't forget we grew up in scarcity, we don't realize that, for example, our next meal, all you have to do is walk down to the grocery store, mm-hmm. And spend a few shillings, and you get as much calorie as you need for a whole day. As I said, and you mentioned, used to have to fight and run for that food, and so we are overwhelmed. We don't know what to do with abundance. We know what to do in scarcity. I mean, the interesting thing about our current meltdown is that actually it potentially is socially very good for us because we're starting to think again. America has enormous entrepreneurial talent, enormous skills, enormous energy, enormous optimism. But we're now faced with something, I hope, that will force us into thinking laterally, thinking outside the box, rather than just wondering about, you know, what color should my next iPod be?
Dr. Peter Weibrow is our guest. 410-319-8888. His most recent book is American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. And William in Queens, New York, you're on the air.
Yes, Mark, what a guest. What an amazing guest.
He is.
I had a couple of questions, a couple of things came to mind listening here. First thing is that we always think that choice is a mark of freedom rather than confusion. And it's a little bit jarring to come to that conclusion that it's actually causing tremendous confusion. You know, this whole discussion reminds me of the fall of the Roman Republic, which was essentially a city-state government grappling with the distortions of running a huge empire, and it just couldn't cope with it. My question is this, and I'm happy to hear any comments you might have about the rest of that stuff I just said, but is there a chance in your mind that all of the crises we are confronting right now could prompt us to evolve somehow as a species? Or are we just destined for, catastrophe? That's kind of my question. I'll just sign off and listen. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Well, I like your framing of that. I, too, think sometimes that we're sort of into the Roman Empire. You know, the reason why they invaded England, which was my old country, is because they'd run out of tin and wood to smelt it. And so you can see the edge of the empire. We're now in Iraq and places because we need the oil. I mean, there's a great similarity. So I think that but coming back, are we destined for catastrophe? I like to think we are not. I mean, I'm basically an optimist. I guess as a migrant, we're all optimists who live here. And I think that we do, however, have to have enough of a shock to start thinking laterally, as I said. And that is what the current meltdown probably will help us with. My worry is that as soon as things go back to being reasonably good again economically, we'll begin to forget that we have to plan in different ways, and we'll go back to just enjoying the moment and creating a circumstance where we will indeed exsanguinate not ourselves necessarily, but the planet. So that I think we have to be thoughtful about that. And you see, long-term planning is our great skill, but we don't really enjoy it as much as we enjoy that tiramisu I was telling you about.
But you know, you when you write to us about that, right in your just going back to the article for a moment, that you talk about the American dream being really dangerously addictive, and you write to say that America's productivity per person per hour is comparable to the most European nations, but our consumption is greater by one third. And here's the point that we all live through. You say we finance it by working longer hours, sleeping less, cutting back on vacations, neglecting our families, and taking on huge amounts of debt. And that probably speaks to almost every American listening to this show.
That's true. And you see, that's why, although it's fun to blame AIG, those guys were just basically doing what the rest of us have been doing. They're doing it on a grand scale. And so suddenly they melt down and everybody gets terrified because they're so tied into the international scene that they can't afford to melt down. Whereas when the poor little Joe melts down because his house he can no longer afford, or he's maxed his credit cards out and then suddenly loses his job, nobody seems to worry about that. But it's the same behavioral context in which we are finding ourselves. Everybody has been trying to grab too much too quickly, and therefore we have essentially mortgaged our lives into the future, and every now and again we are caught up short in the Great Depression, which is a little different from now, but it's a similar problem to what we're facing.
So if you can, in the couple of minutes we have left here, just talk a bit about where your thoughts have taken you about how we resolve this. I mean, where do we take this for our species and our nation?
Well, I have started to think about that. In fact, I worry about that. I mean, as our caller said, that's really the critical issue, is what do we do next? And so I think that it does come down to this whole issue of how do we develop a society with sustainable material wealth. That means that we are able to manage a planet that has finite resources, but we're able to live with 6 billion people on its face. And at the same time, think through what is the other wealth that we need to sustain a life which is fun. I'll give you one example. You know, we're all very curious creatures. That's one of our great assets. The curiosity, if we had more time, I would explain that the curiosity emerged because that was how we stayed alive. You know, if you picked up every rock to find out whether there was something you'd eat underneath it, that's curiosity, yes? And the curiosity is something which we love. That's why we love everything novel. That's why we like a pink iPod rather than a white iPod, because it goes with our outfit or whatever. But I think that the issue is how do you create a society where we are able to indulge that type of curiosity and, for example, social ambition? How do we create an opportunity for people to rise through a social hierarchy and to get the feedback that everybody wants, a feedback which says, we really are, you know, indebted to you. You are a wonderful person. And your last guest,
Wangari Maathai,
she's worked hard in the vineyard, metaphorically, all her life, and she is now revered because of the extraordinary things she's tried to do for Africa. That type of social reinforcement feeds the social ambition just as well as buying a Mercedes.
Well, I wish we did have more time. We hope to have you back again and maybe in a discussion with a number of others for a couple of hours to talk just about these issues. I think they're very important for all of us. Dr. Peter Weibrauch, thank you so much for joining us in this last half hour.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And we want to thank Bob Carlson at our sister station, KCRW in L.A., for engineering the other half of the ISDN. Thank you so much for being with us. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Additional help in the studio from Ashley Boddy. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear additional new interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.